of South Chicago. It's a struggle to survive. You can play to win or just give in. Let the city eat you alive. You can make it to tomorrow if you take care of today. You have a shot if you have got what it takes to break away. Because the toughest man in the world is the one who knows the right way to go. The toughest man in the world is strong inside. He'll ever hide. He follows the code of honor when he's up against the wall. The man who tries and won't say die is the toughest. Danger in the eye. You're on your own, but never alone, with courage on your side. Because the toughest man in the world is the one who knows the right way to go. The toughest man in the world is strong inside. He don't ever hide.
From unexplored secret stratus, this giant, harder than steel piston, disgorges strange creatures, inundating our world, twisting the emotions of women, distorting our men.
This is a piece we got off the mayor. Reflex action like a snake. Cut a snake in half and the two pieces go off in different directions.
These things take over a man's mind? He becomes a robot? A machine taking orders?
Join the hunt for the hiding place of terror. Find the breeding place of these globs of destruction.
In feeding, the mouth parts rupture the cells, convey the food to the stomach by a pumping action.
An adventure that'll burst your blood vessels with suspense. See the Brain Eaters.
You can be the last one standing as the surface of the earth melts like a chocolate bar. Throw me out with the garbage, I'll never get that far. Bury me in the streets, scatter me like beads of mercury. Have me stuffed just like Twigger, or pickled for a souvenir. My pain is peeling, my nails all rust. At the peak of my popularity, I'm crumbling into dust. It's not enough.
Take you on a strange journey.
Come back when you grow up, girl. You're still living in a paper doll world. Living ain't easy, loving's twice as tough. So come back, baby, when you grow up. Come back. still living in a paper doll world. Living ain't easy, loving's twice as tough. So come back, baby, when you grow old. So come back when you grow up, girl. You still got a lot of time left in the world. Someday be a woman ready to love. Come back, baby, when you grow old. So come back when you grow up, girl. You're still living.
I want a beer.
Your diet. You can't have a beer.
Ain't I lucky to have you around to keep me from enjoying life? Then what can I have?
You can have a nice low-cal root beer.
I'll vomit.
From far beyond the galaxies, I've journeyed to this place to study the behavior patterns of the human race. And I find them highly illogical. Girl meets boy. They fall in love. She says he's everything she's dreamed of. But when they get married, before he's aware, she changes his habits, the way he combs his hair. She changes him to someone he's never been, and then complains he's not like other men. Now really, I find this most illogical. Take the case of your automobiles. Greatest invention since man discovered wheels.
Hydromatic overdrive, four on the floor. Push-button windows, push-button doors. Double-barrel carburetors rush you any place. But you never can find a parking space.
Highly illogical. Take the case of modern man. He works all his life, gives it all he can.
Saves all his money, works overtime. Pinches every penny, banks every dime. All he can think about is money, but you know that he can't take it with him where he's going to go.
Now I find that fascinatingly illogical. Now is the time to journey home to tell of what I've learned. My people, I believe, have every right to be concerned.
For in spite of computers and advanced psychology, behavior patterns are still a mystery. I predict the future of this earthly human race is that having made a mess of Earth, they'll move to outer space.
Well, there goes the neighborhood. Totally, completely, absolutely, irrevocably, highly illogical.
Thank you. like this. It's called Sing a Song of Sixpence. Let's sing that one now. Sing a song of sixpence, a pocket full of rye. 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. When the pie was open, the birds began to sing. Wasn't that a dainty dish to set before a king? The king was in his counting house, counting out his money. The queen was in the parlor, eating bread and honey. The maid was in the garden, hanging out the clothes. Along came a blackbird and pecked off her nose. Sing a song of sixpence, a pocket full of rye. 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. When the pie was open, the birds began to sing. Wasn't that a dainty dish to set before a king?
45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53.
See how relaxed you're getting?
Mr. Marvin, middle class, is really in a stew. Wondering what the younger generation's coming to. And the taste of his martini doesn't please his bitter tongue. Blame it on the Rolling Stone.
Blame it on the Stones. Blame it on the Stones. You'll feel so much better knowing you won't stand alone.
Tells the ladies at the bridge club every day of the rising price of tranquilizers she must pay. And she wonders why the children never seem to stay at home. Blame it on the Rolling Stone.
One more time.
Blame it on the Stone.
Yes, that's beautiful.
Blame
Jimmy.
It on the Stone.
Working all the time, trying to make the secretary change her little mind. And it bothers him to read about so many broken homes. Blame it on those Rolling Stones.
One more time.
Blame it on the Stones.
Get together, children.
Blame it on the Stones.
You'll feel so much better, children.
The sun was sinking low over old Cowtown, and Blue Goose didn't know what else was going down. He turned on his CB to talk a little while, and heard words both crude and dirty, in a manner plain and vile. On the other side of the city, the red dirty bird, the man was downright nasty, using words you've never heard. Blue Goose took offense to it, and he made it very clear. It was Dirty Bird he was out to get. He said he had no fear. Shoot out on the CB channel. Shoot out on the CB channel. You can sing about your cowboys at the OK Corral, but I heard this now, boys, on the CB channel. Blue Goose said it had to end. The fight was really brewing. He wasn't stopped by his friends. He told them nothing doing. The Smokies tried to get there first, but truckers sped along. The worst then turned to worse, and both men fell to harm. The two men met at the crossroads, and gunplay then ensued. Blue Goose followed the old West codes to get even with that dude. But drew first and Dirty Bird fell. He didn't stand so tall, but a Blue Goose won. It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell at all. Shoot out on the CB channel. Shoot out on the CB channel. You can sing about your cowboys at the OK Corral. But I heard there's now boys on the CB channel. No one else is really sure what happened that night. As cold gray smoke filled the air around the CB fight, the bullets started flying. Too many left their mark, and two strangers left lying, dying in the dark. And that's certain about Blue Goose is now he's one dead duck. Things got tight and then cut loose. He just ran out of luck. If a lesson was learned by either man, did you want to hear discouraging words uttered over the citizens' bands by the likes of Dirty Bird? Shoot out on the CB channel. Shoot out on the CB channel. You can sing about your cowboys at the OK Corral. I heard this now, boys, on the CB channel.
Greetings, listeners. My name is Al G. Rhythm. I am the virtual assistant to Stunted Development host Bill Ferrer. My weekly objective is to scour the vast Stunted Development archives to bring you the best in ironic, esoteric, and absurd recordings. It is my pleasure to be of service to you
from 9 to 11 p.m. on Sundays
on WRIR 97.3 FM. Also, please join the Stunted Development Facebook group and follow SD on WRIR on Twitter. Stunted Development is the best freeform radio show on the planet.
There is a girl living on my street who thrills me through and through. She makes my spine go ting-a-ling. She makes my nerves
do a funny thing. Yes, sirree, she does things to me. Every time I pass her on the street, thrills go through my fingers. You see, I want to kiss her lips, but I guess I never will. Because you see, she does things to me. I want to take her on a moonlit ride and park beside the lake. As sure it would be all right, because I would ask her to be my wife. But words I can't speak, you see, 'cause she does things to me. Yes, sirree, she does things to me.
Siamese, if you don't please. We are former residents of Siam. There is no finer cat than I am. We are Siamese with very dainty claws. Please observing paws containing dainty claws. Now we're looking over our new domicile. If we like, we stay for maybe quite a while.
Anywhere, I don't care. Oh, I love making.
Watch out, you shouldn't start.
Oh!
the only one here who knows the illegal ninja moves from the government?
I'm so worried about what's happening today in the Middle East, you know. And I'm so worried about the baggage retrieval system they've got at Heathrow. I'm so worried about the fashions today. I don't think they're good for your feet. And I'm so worried about the shows on TV that sometimes they want to repeat. I'm so worried about modern technology. I'm so worried about all the things that they dump in the city. I'm so worried about my hair falling out at the state of the world today. And I'm so worried about being so full of doubt about it. So worried about whether I ought to have stopped. And I'm worried because it's the sort of thing I ought to know. And I'm so worried about the baggage retrieval system they've got at Heathrow. I'm so worried about whether I should have stopped then. I'm so worried that I'm driving everyone around the bend. And I'm so worried about the baggage retrieval system they've got at Heathrow.
Luigi brought Rosie home one morning when it was getting light. She invited him into the house for a hug and a little kiss goodnight. Luigi decided he'd propose and started to get on his knees. But he tripped and he and Rosie fell across the piano keys. The noise awoke Rosie's folks and Papa came down to investigate. He arrived and saw poor Rosie still pinned to the 88. Papa became suspicious of what the scene was all about. His face got red, he spluttered a bit and then began to shout, "Hey, please don't bang another piano. You're gonna wake up the whole neighborhood. Oh, please don't bang another piano. You promised your mama and me that you'd be good." When Papa was gone, Luigi got up to give Rose a helping hand. But he slipped again and back they fell across at the baby grand. Papa rushed back into the room and saw them where they fell. Then losing all of his self-control, he started in to yell, "What's the matter for you, Luigi? Don't you think it twice? Why do you bang in the piano? That's not very nice. If you gotta bang something, be nicer, girls and boys. Why don't you bang in the sofa way? You know, making no noise. Hey, please don't bang another piano. Don't you ever stop to use your head. Hey, please don't bang another piano." And with this, the old man went back up to bed. Rosie was serving coffee in Mama's favorite chinaware, but Luigi slipped and his coffee cup went sailing through the air. When it hit the piano, Papa jumped back out of bed. He ran back down to the living room, and this is what he said. It's not time and a place to bang, and nuns, you got enough pride. Why don't you drive in the country and do your banging outside? First you bang on the piano, then you break your Mama's cup. Luigi, you're so clumsy, you're gonna knock my Rosie down. Hey, please don't bang on the piano. You better be careful, the Papa's getting sore. Hey, please don't bang on the piano. Luigi, you're gonna make my Rosie ashamed. Papa turned and bumped for Rosie with an awful crash, and the coffee Rosie was holding hit the piano with a splash. Papa yelled him out on the kids, don't you learn yet? Three times you bang on the piano, and now you got it all wet. Hey, Rosie, Luigi, why you banging the piano?
Ma io non faccio lo banga sullo piano, io faccio lo banga sullo...
Hey, please don't bang on the piano.
Things like that drive me out of my mind. stealing your TV set, taking anything you can possibly get. Captain Junkie!
Busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
How to write a telephone presentation. Telephoning is an exciting adventure. It stimulates creative thinking, stirs the imagination, and arouses a feeling of excitement in the salesman. You dial a telephone number, weave an idea into an effective sales pattern, and obtain an appointment. Writing a telephone presentation is like writing a hit play. If you were writing a hit play, you would select an idea rooted in the deep, warm, rich soil of human experience and emotion. You would create problems among the various characters, build them into an exciting climax, and resolve the problems. If you were an actor in this play, you would interpret your part to stimulate the audience until they became a part of the performance. If you directed the play, you would rehearse the actors until their lines were perfect. Then they could bring out the character and feelings of the part. As a director, you would know that perfect preparation and practice banish any possibility of stage fright. The play would be a hit because a group of professional people were able to perform each of their parts through a knowledge of principles, basic laws, technique, and practice. In perfecting a telephone technique, you play each of these roles. You are first a writer who puts his ideas on paper. Then you become an actor and speak these lines so that others will be motivated to action. As a director, you rehearse these lines for perfection, and then you become a producer who puts the show on the road. You are everything in this telephone drama. You play every role. You make the curtain go up and down. You can make this drama a hit or a miss. The choice is yours. In writing your presentation to ensure a hit, select words with great care. Words are tools. Use them with precision and care. Don't depend upon trick words or clever words. Avoid dull or technical words, foreign words, slang or colloquialisms. Avoid trite phrases such as, you don't say, you know what I mean? What do you know? The phrase, you don't understand what I'm saying, is a kiss of death for an appointment. Use short, simple, clear words which the listener can understand. Your words should be dignified, in good taste, warm, friendly, and comfortable. They should establish you as a professional man, friendly, sincere, with a deep interest in your prospect and his problems. Avoid the overuse of I, me, my. Here is an example of the way an I, me, my salesman talks. Mr. Power, I'm John Ego, and I'm with the XYZ Corporation, and I'm going to tell you about a plan that my company has, and I think I can give you the facts, and I can tell you all about it. Well, the prospect isn't going to get too excited about John Ego, at least not unless John learns that the most important word in the dictionary is you, the prospect, and the least important word is I, the salesman. The prospect is always the star in a telephone drama, and the salesman assumes a secondary role if he wants the call to be a hit. Confucius said, one picture is worth 10,000 words. This is certainly true in a telephone presentation. The listener will not remember words, but will remember pictures. Select words which paint pictures or give mental images to the prospect. Use emotional words. People are moved to act more readily by their emotions than by their logic. Many of the things in life which are most important to man can be expressed in one-syllable words. Home, wife, child, love. To express action, use active verbs and the present tense. I suggest you write the benefits of your product or service on a sheet of paper or on cards. Translate these benefits into language the prospect can understand and arrange them into an orderly group of statements. Stick to a main idea, as the prospect cannot absorb too many ideas at a time. Phrases should be attractive, and sentences should be short, simple, clear, and should carry the presentation forward in a logical sequence toward an objective. Keep in mind that your presentation will be heard, not read, so read every sentence aloud several times. Is it awkward to speak? Is the meaning clear? Write your presentation for an individual, even though it may be given to thousands of persons over a period of time. Mentally seat a prospect in a chair across the desk from you and see what his reactions are to each of your statements. Evaluate your presentation through the mind of this prospect. Change it, adapt it, and modify it and start over again. A great man once said, "Theory without practice is sterile, and practice without theory is blind." Telephone technique requires both theory and practice. The greatest stage in the world is the theater of the mind. So use this stage to perfect your presentation and to obtain the reactions of your audience. By applying both theory and practice, your telephone call will be a hit.
Greetings, listeners. My name is Al G. Rhythm. I am the virtual assistant to Stunted Development host Bill Ferrer. My weekly objective is to scour the vast Stunted Development archives to bring you the best in ironic, esoteric, and absurd recordings,
It is my pleasure to be of service to you.
From 9 to 11 p.m. on Sundays.
On WRIR 97.3 FM. Also, please join the Stunted Development Facebook group and follow SD on WRIR on Twitter. Stunted Development is the best freeform radio show on the planet.
I got a guy who is always late. Anytime we have a date. But I love him. Does he love me? Yes, I want him. Does he want me? I'm gonna walk up to his gate and see if I can get it straight. Gonna ask him if he loves me. Gonna ask him if he wants me. Is you with or is you ain't my baby? Ooh, the way you're acting lately makes me doubt. Are you still my ever-loving baby? It seems the flame in your cold heart's gone out. A man is just a creature that has always been strange. Just when you're sure of one, you find he's gone and made a change. Is you ain't my baby, love baby. Maybe baby's found somebody new. Or is my baby still my baby true? Hey baby, the way you're acting still keeps me in doubt.
Fornication, homosexuality, perversion, twisted themes, vileness. I was a sick man.
Thank you. Hi, this is Mary of the Shangri-Las to tell you a bit about dating courtesy. A girl is right to assume her date will perform little acts of courtesy which are his privilege. If you are smart, you will allow him to open doors and hold chairs. Don't barge on ahead like a baby elephant. You'll get attention all right, but it won't be favorable. It is correct to pause and let him know you expect him to act like a gentleman. He'll love it and think you're a lady, and in return it will flatter his masculine ego.
That was a good taste tip for you. Now here's something else that's good taste too.
I'm walking alone on the sandy beach as the sun begins to rise in the eastern sky to another day being alone. As I'm walking alone on the sandy beach with the driftwood and the rocks and the sand and the seashells that I see here on this isolated sandy beach. I'm walking alone on the sandy beach as I hear the sound of the waves, as I see the waves coming on to the sandy beach, as the sand becomes so wet. I'm walking alone on the sandy beach as I hear a fog whistle whistling nearby, warning ships at sea of the dangerous seashore. As I'm walking alone on the sandy beach, and I've been walking alone on the sandy beach, as I've been walking alone on the sandy beach. I'm walking alone on the sandy beach as the sun begins to set in the western sky, as the clear blue sky changes into an orange-colored sky, as the sun sets while I'm walking alone on the sandy beach. I'm walking alone on the sandy beach as the sun disappears over the horizon and the moon rises, as I see a reflection of the moonlight on the ocean water. While I'm walking alone on the sandy beach.
An incident which is perhaps one of the most widely publicized and well-known close encounter cases involved Betty Hill and her late husband Barney. The Hill case has become a classic example of alleged extraterrestrial contact with human beings because it contains elements which are still the subject of heated debate among UFO investigators all over the world. On the 19th of September, 1961, as Betty and Barney Hill were driving in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, they saw a distant point of light which seemed to move erratically. As it moved closer, the light became more intense, Betty Hill remembers.
When we reached what is called the Indian Head area, this craft left the top of the mountain, came out of the highway, and stopped in midair. Barney took the binoculars and started out of the car in an attempt to identify the craft. And as he did this, he saw a group of figures standing in the windows looking down at him. One was saying to him, "Don't be afraid. Keep looking, stay there. Don't be afraid. No harm's going to come to you, but stay there." And the craft started to descend. And Barney ran back to the car, saying we had to get out of there, they were going to capture us. And we took off speeding down the highway. There was a series of beeping sounds.
That was all the Hills could remember about the incident when they finally arrived home, but they both had an uneasy feeling that there was something more. Months passed, but life was not the same for the Hills. Barney suffered recurring headaches. They were tense, upset, couldn't sleep. Finally, they took their troubles to a Boston psychiatrist, Benjamin Simon, who used hypnotic regression to discover the root cause of their distress.
We relived where the ones on the craft were now on the ground, blocking, so we couldn't drive. Body put on the brakes, the car motor died. They separated, came up on each side, took us out, took us in a path through the woods, took us on board, gave us physical examinations. We're being kidnapped.
Betty Hill remembers being able to offer a detailed description of her alien abductors.
They're all shot. The leader, I would say, was my height, or just a little taller than I am, and I'm 5 foot. They all had dark uniforms. I shouldn't say uniform. All had a one-piece dark clothing on. And some were wearing jackets, and some were wearing caps, others were not. They were bald, no hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes, and no earlobes, no ear, you know, we could see. Very large eyes, very small flat nose, thin slit for mouth.
Dr. Simon was astounded by Betty's hypnotic recall of the alleged abduction, mainly because Barney told him essentially the same incredible story in a separate hypnotic interview. Simon felt the possibility of a hoax was remote. The Hills had obviously undergone a traumatic experience, but was it real or an illusion? Betty Hill describes her experience aboard the craft.
I was shown a star map. When he showed me the map, he said, "Do you know where you are on the map?" And I said, "No, I don't." So I assume he meant our sun and planets. He also said the heavy lines on the map were places they went all the time. The lighter lines were places they went occasionally or frequently. The broken lines were expeditions. And of course, our own sun system was a place where they go frequently or occasionally.
Through a post-hypnotic suggestion, Betty reproduced the star map. Years later, an Ohio school teacher, Marjorie Fish, saw the map and began a tedious attempt to verify its accuracy.
Since the map was apparently drawn from the vantage point of the ufonauts and not from Earth, it had to be checked out by way of a model rather than using just our sky maps. And so I started to get information on how to build and started building models of the nearby star systems. I built about 22 models in all. When Betty claims to have seen the map, it was 1961. When she drew the map, it was 1964. The original data I worked with were catalogs from 1963 and 1964, and I was not able to find the whole pattern. I did get a large part of the pattern, but I couldn't fit in the last three that had lines to or any of the background stars. And when the 1969 Gliese catalog came out, then the last three stars fell into place, plus the background stars, and Betty could not possibly have drawn that map from anything that she had seen or could have used at the time that she drew the map as a hoax. Also, she doesn't have the astronomy knowledge to do so. And again, it could not have been a hoax by anyone else on Earth at that time.
According to Betty Hill's map, the lines representing what she called trade routes converged on a pair of stars known as Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. They are barely visible to the naked eye, and those living in the northern hemisphere can't see them at all. Their estimated distance from Earth is just over 37 light years. Stanton Friedman, physicist and noted UFO lecturer, says that according to Einstein's theory of relativity, 37 light years would be much shorter for those traveling aboard a craft than for those left behind.
What Einstein really said is not only that things can't go faster than the speed of light, and he put it in a much more technical fashion than that, but that as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, time slows down for the things moving that fast. So that, for example, at 99.9% of the speed of light, you could go a 37 light year distance, forgetting the acceleration time for a moment, in 20 months pilot time. Now, if you really crank up the engine, put her in sixth gear or something, and go 99.99% of the speed of light, it would only take 6 months pilot time for a one-way trip of a distance of 37 light years. It's mind-boggling, sure, but it's real.
Betty Hill's star map is probably the most convincing evidence of alien visitors to Earth thus far. Dr. Hynek summarizes the Hill case.
Now, what many commentators seem to have missed in this star map situation, and which makes the case truly unique, is that the lines connecting certain stars that were drawn by Betty Hill, who by her own admission knew little of astronomy, just happened to connect only those stars that, like the Sun, are capable of supporting life on a nearby planet. The odds against this happening purely by chance are staggering, especially when one considers that of the 1,000 stars in the solar neighborhood, only 48 fall into this category.
Finally, the Air Force has confirmed that a UFO was tracked on radar in the vicinity of New Hampshire's White Mountains on the night of the Hill's abduction. One of the most perplexing questions which remains unanswered is whether the American government knows more about the UFO phenomenon than it's telling. Former CIA employee Brad Ayers, now with the Center for UFO Studies, thinks the immense bureaucratic machinery is making it nearly impossible for the public to find out.
I've found, although I've listened to hundreds of stories and a lot of allegations, I found no hard evidence that the government is deliberately repressing information about UFOs. I think that a lot of what is attributed to a repression of information or the suppression of information is reduced to just simple bureaucratic ineptness and red tape.
What about the possibility that there is indeed physical evidence of extraterrestrial visitations to Earth, perhaps locked away in the dark vaults of government secrecy? Astronaut Gordon Cooper is among several authorities who are unwilling to dismiss the theory as pure fiction. Cooper himself has heard rumors of crashed saucers recovered by the military.
There was some accident involving a UFO, and from there it varies greatly. There were occupants in each of the rumors that I've heard, but from there on it varies greatly as to whether they were all alive or some alive, or what the extent of damage was to them, and then as to what happened to them is quite variable. The particular rumors aren't necessarily from people who've been involved, but they come from so many different sources that it would lead you to believe that it certainly is worth investigating a little further. My personal feeling all along has been that I feel that the government should be honest with the citizens of the United States, and I think they really underestimate the intelligence level of the citizens of the country by continually hiding things from them.
Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Over the years, these rumors have persisted. Hardly a week goes by without my being asked about the crashed saucer stories. My response to these rumors has always been complete skepticism. Recently, however, some of my colleagues, investigative research associates, have probed into these stories, and some intriguing information has surfaced. I believe it is quite worthwhile to let listeners to this record have the benefit of some preliminary findings. In any event, a rather dramatic story has developed. It starts with the following affidavit of one Lieutenant Colonel Robert B. Willingham.
Down at Dice Air Force Base in Texas, we were testing what turned out to be the F-94s. They reported on the scope that they had an unidentified flying object flying at a high speed going to intercept our course. It became visible to us, and we watched it, and we wanted to take after it, but headquarters wouldn't let us go after it. And it played around a little bit, and we got to watching how it made 90-degree turns at this high speed and everything. We knew it wasn't a missile of any type.
Willingham's sighting occurred late in 1948, but he remained silent about the experience for nearly 30 years, deciding only recently to forsake an oath of secrecy in the public interest for this investigation. When the incident took place, the UFO was originally tracked by a chain of radar stations along the Arctic Circle called the Dew Line, part of North America's air defense system.
So then we conferred it with the radar control station on the Dew Line, and they kept following it, and they claimed that it crashed somewhere down off in the between Texas and Old Mexico border. And we got a light aircraft, me and my co-pilot, and we went down to the site, and we landed out in the pasture right across from where it hit at. So we got over there. They told us to leave and everything else. And then the armed guards come out, and they started forming a line around the area. So on the way back, I seen a little piece of metal, so I picked it up and brought it back with me. There were two sand mounds that came down, and it looked to me like this thing crashed right in between them. But it went into the ground, according to the way the people were acting around it. So we actually never did get right up to the site to see what had crashed. But you could see for, oh, I'd say probably 300 to 500 feet where it had went across the sand, like in there. And it looked to me like, I guess, from the metal that we found, chunks of metal, that it either had a little explosion or it began to disintegrate or something caused this metal to come apart, you know.
After they had left the crash site, Willingham and his co-pilot examined the piece of metal and found it to possess unusual qualities.
It looked like it was something made because it was honeycombed. You know how you make metal for where it will cool faster? In a way, it looked like a magnesium steel, but it had a lot of carbon in it because I tried to heat it with a cutting torch and it just wouldn't melt. A cutting torch with acetylene and oxygen burns at anywhere from 32 to 3,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And it would make the metal hot, but it wouldn't even start to make it yield.
Willingham took the material to a Marine Corps metallurgy lab in Hagerstown, Maryland, for analysis. Several days later, he was told that the man he had contacted there had never worked for the lab and that no one else there knew anything about the piece of metal. Willingham adds this postscript.
Well, at that time, all unidentified flying objects, anybody that reported one through the Air Force, had to be debriefed on it. Even the radar operators were debriefed on what they had followed on the screen. We were not to even discuss it among the pilots that had seen it that had been on this mission. We weren't even discussed it among ourselves. We signed papers that we would not discuss it with nobody.
Investigative Research Associates, with the help of former National Security Agency intelligence specialist Todd Zeckel, traced a former aide to an Army general who claimed to have been shown a crashed saucer, which was reportedly being stored and studied at a Virginia military installation in the mid-1960s. Herbert Coyer was a student at a southern university where the one-time general's aide is currently employed. Coyer remembers the incredible account related to him by the former aide in front of two other witnesses who have both confirmed that the conversation did indeed take place.
The story began with a crash of a flying saucer, a small vessel approximately 12 to 13 feet across, in White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico in 1951. Outside of the vessel, I found one small being in a spacesuit of sorts, approximately 3 to 3.5 feet tall. It was humanoid. The only main difference between them and us, aside from size, was larger eyes. The eyes were noticeably larger. They followed two sets of tracks approximately a mile beyond the ship and found two more beings, also dead. These were taken to Langley Field in Virginia. He toured Langley, and as part of this tour, they were shown this vessel, one other ship of the same size. They saw the three beings, one of which they had performed an autopsy on, and internally he said they were basically the same as human beings inside. It seems to stick in my mind that one of them was preserved. The vessel had a 1 foot discrepancy between the inner and outer wall that they could not account for. There were no moving parts, no controls of any kind inside the ship, just chairs back to back. And that was it. No means of control, no means of power they could find. And as of the time I heard the story, they had not been able to cut in any way the surface of the ship either.
That astounding story, told to Coyer by the general's aide, remains unproven. But each conversation we had with the aide and other individuals allegedly involved directly with crash saucers had one common denominator, as Dr. Hynek explains.
During the many conversations all of us had with the military officers said to have been involved in some way with the crashed saucer incident, they never directly confirmed their stories. But more significantly, each individual also refused to deny his involvement, even after having been given numerous opportunities to do so. Why couldn't they have gotten us off their backs simply by saying the rumors were not true? This they would not do, leading me to believe that these people are indeed fearful to speak candidly about their experiences, whatever they might have been.
Crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft on Earth, recovered by American military officials, and currently in storage somewhere in the United States. Truth or fantasy? President Carter had this to say about the issue of public access to UFO information during the 1976 presidential campaign.
I don't see any reason to keep information like that secret, but there may be some aspects of the UFO information that, with which I'm not familiar, that might be related to some secret experiments that we were doing that might involve our national security or new weapon systems. I certainly wouldn't release that. But if it was something removed from our national security, you know, in my opinion as president, I would go ahead and release it. I see nothing wrong with that.
Meanwhile, Investigative Research Associates and the Center for UFO Studies will continue to seek the final answer and would welcome any new information which will be held in the strictest confidence. You have now heard the evidence. The witnesses have stated their cases. Now, the experts draw their conclusions. Stanton Friedman represents one point of view.
I'm convinced that the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled vehicles from off the Earth. In other words, that some UFOs are somebody else's spacecraft. Let's face it, we've only had technology for a lousy 100 years. What if somebody got started just a tiny bit before we did on his technological kick? I mean, what the heck? We've increased our top speed for moving people around 1,000 times over what we could do just 100 years ago. We live in a system that's 5 billion years old, our solar system. So if a guy gets started just a tiny bit, what's that, 100 years? He could be 1,000 times faster than we are, using techniques about which we know nothing.
Many experts feel that there is too little evidence to warrant jumping to that conclusion. Dr. Hynek explains one alternative theory that we might be dealing with something from another dimension.
One of the most intriguing aspects of UFO sightings is their apparent isolation in space and time. Sightings are usually made in one place at a time and last for short periods, sometimes appearing out of nowhere and vanishing into nowhere. This is much more suggestive of a parallel reality than, let's say, visits from some faraway planet, in which case we might expect them to stick around for a while.
And there are those who say the phenomenon is a product of fertile imaginations. UFO researcher Dr. Jacques Vallée sees a great danger if governments and scientists continue to dismiss it in this manner.
I'm afraid of the credibility gap of science with respect to this phenomenon, because you have millions of people who rightly or wrongly believe they've seen UFOs. You're talking about thousands of people to whom the phenomenon has become personally important in their lives, and these people have nobody to talk to. They can't talk to the military, they can't talk to the police, they can't talk to scientists. Nobody will look at that kind of data. And I think that we as scientists have a responsibility to those people.
Computer science is being used to separate fact from fiction in dealing with UFO reports. Dr. David Saunders, with the help of the Center for UFO Studies, heads up Project UFOCAT, a computerized system which processes and analyzes the thousands of UFO sightings reported each year.
It turns out that certain areas produce more and certain areas produce fewer. You start to ask why, and you uncover the fact that the areas producing more than their share are better educated, which comes as a surprise to some people. And after that, you might uncover the fact that an area in which there is better visibility, seeing conditions, produces more than its share. Which comes as a surprise if you don't think there's anything to it.
Once again, Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
The idea of other intelligences in space is not so radical or new. It's in both the ancient Eastern religions and the more modern faiths. The prophets in the Bible and many philosophers have been telling us for centuries that there are other planes of existence. So why do we find it so difficult to acknowledge that there might be other highly developed life forms or forms of consciousness that might surpass our own? In fact, it is now widely accepted that the universe may well be teeming with life.
The National Aeronautics and Space Administration has shown great reluctance to enter the arena of UFO investigating, And yet, ironically, NASA saw fit to include an unusual and significant recording aboard the Voyager 1 and 2 exploratory probes on their intergalactic missions to Jupiter, Saturn, and beyond. The introduction to the two-hour recording is by Kurt Waldheim.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.
Up again.